Donald in the kitchen talks about food. Donald in the kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintos.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we're here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa, the center of Iowa, the center of it all. Thanks for joining us today. Well, first, I wish to respond a little bit to the weather outside.
Oh, cabin fever.
Burr.
Oh. It's gorgeous out, though. I mean, it's white. It's sunny. You can look out the window, but if you open the window, you're
in trouble because we are experiencing quite a winter. I hope you all know where your hats and mittens are because you sure need them today. Another thing, out that cold, cold window with all that snow and sunshine, I've been watching my bird feeder lately, and I do like feeding the birds. I put out suet, and I put out a kind of a mixed, whatever I can get on sale, kind of bird seed for everybody.
How do you keep the squirrels out of your suet? Or do you?
No, squirrels don't go for suet.
I beg to differ.
You're kidding.
No, it's a constant battle at my house.
Really?
Those squirrels, I used to hang it in a tree, for goodness sake. The squirrels are like, I mean, if I want to do squirrel watching really close to the window, just hang out the suet. Oh, yeah, they're omnivores, I believe.
Well, my suet is hanging from a long metal hook off of a...
Ah, yes, squirrel-proof. Okay.
I don't think they can get to... They can get to the feeder occasionally, but it's quite a... They have to do quite a bit of machinations to get this.
They're such acrobats. Yeah.
And they fall off every now and then.
Well, I'm a good squirrel watcher, I must say.
Yeah. So my suet is kind of away from where squirrels get, but everybody likes the feeder, and I wish to report here at the last part of January, I haven't seen this bird in years. I saw a red-headed woodpecker.
Oh, a real one.
A real red-headed woodpecker. The kind, male and female, both have an honest-to-God red head.
Not just the little speck on the breast. Are they bigger than, what's that little one called? Is that the pileated?
The pileated are really big. They're really big.
Oh, pileated are even bigger. Well, what are those little ones that you see everywhere all the time that are, you can always hear them?
Yeah, those are either the downy or the hairy. The downy are a little smaller, and the hairy are a little bigger with a longer bill.
So it's probably the downies all the time. Yeah.
And I get a lot of red-bellied woodpeckers. They have a rosy belly, actually. Uh-huh. And they just have a little red, kind of a little hat, a little mohawk going.
Uh-huh.
But honest to goodness,
a real red-headed,
real-life red-headed,
like that's
woodpecker.
The woody woodpecker kind.
It was. It didn't stay around long. I think they must be kind of shy. I've never seen them around a bird.
Well, they must be a little bit rare, too.
Yeah.
And are they big, like,
yeah, they're,
like blackbird size? Or
let's see. 9 1/4 inches long. That's,
Not quite black. Like blue jay size, maybe.
Yeah.
Huh.
Anyhow. Anyway, I wish to report that, and plus lots of other good little birdies popping around out there. Well, good luck to all of those who are foraging out in the wilderness. So, today on the Donalana Kitchen, we're going to talk about cooking with fats, because fat has got a bad rap.
Yeah,
but
suet is beef fat.
Suet.
And the reason you put it out is, of course, because they need high energy food in this cold weather.
Yes, lots of birds.
And
love
in their wisdom,
stuff.
They come right for it.
Yes, and they do a good job too. So it's very important. So we're going to talk about about using fat in our cooking, and we're going to talk about the wonderful world of lard. So, Donna, tell us about lard.
Well, lard is one of my favorite fats, and it's, we are in pig country here, so the lard should be ubiquitous. Of course, it's not. You can actually buy lard at the grocery store, but that's not really what I recommend eating because that's been sanitized, bleached, preservatives added.
Bleached? Why would you bleach it?
Well, because you want it to look like Crisco.
Oh dear.
I know. This is a long and sordid history of how we got from lard to something made from cottonseed, which was called cottolene or something like that, and then to the soybean version, and then was called Crisco. I mean, when I was growing up, Crisco wasn't even, it was a brand, but it was used as just the word for shortening, basically, you know. I probably ate a lot of chicken fried in Crisco, and my mother was a big pie maker with Crisco. And, of course, it worked. It worked beautifully.
It was handy. Well, lard, it's that wonderful stuff. It's from the fat. It's what we crave. It's the stuff that holds our cookies and cakes together.
I've made two cakes in the last couple of weeks with lard because I just wanted to see what it would do. And it's wonderful. I think I may not go back to butter cakes again just because. But the thing is, here in Ames, we're in a very envious position because we do have a lot of sort of smaller farmers producing, you know, pastured pork, and you can buy the fat and make your own lard. It's quite simple. Or you can buy lard. I'm sure Wheatsfield has it. But freshly rendered and then refrigerated lard with no additives. Probably Story City Locker has it. We actually have a really readily available supply in town of very, very good lard.
Good. Can you talk a little bit about rendering lard?
Rendering lard. Okay.
So how one does
well,
one do
that? Well, there's two types of fat on the pig. First of all, I want to say that before the invention of before we got into our oil-producing age and lubricants came out of petroleum products, lard and pig fat was widely, widely used for greasing all kinds of things, and as was beef tallow, candles, soap. You know, people did not throw the fat away. It was called the fat of the land. That meant the good parts. Or in English, like in Shakespeare, to lard the earth meant to make it rich, and lard was actually a verb for enriching. Fats are precious. They're very important in the human diet. Our brains are made out of fats, for goodness sake. So in a culture, especially, you know, where we were burning a lot of calories and busy being peasants and working hard, fats were very, very important and scarce. So it was not wasted. And farmers, before the turn of the 1900s, actually made more money off the fat on the pig than they did off of the meat.
Oh, my.
You know, we had to grease a lot of things.
Well, the Industrial Revolution started there in the mid-1900s, and there were all kinds of things being invented
and lots of machines that needed those fats. So lard was a very, very important part of that. Then somewhere in the 1890s or so, they decided, you know, there was a lot of cotton going on, and the cotton seeds were a waste product. So they learned how to press the cotton seeds, and then they created a market for that oil.
Ah.
And then they created a mixture of beef tallow and cotton seed that they was sold as cottolene, C-O-T-T-O-L-E-N-E, and they promoted it.
Was that to eat or to?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Cottolene combines the science and skill of 19th centuries and for health. Cottolene, the healthful shortening. Fairbanks, who was the big promoter of this and kind of cornered the market, his favorite saying was, cottolene shortens your food and lengthens your life.
Oh, well then.
So there was a point. Actually, when my son was at ISU, he wrote a paper called Move Over Lardess, and he interviewed my mother about, you know, when she switched because she was that generation. So she was born in 1911, and she grew up on a farm in southeast Missouri. And, of course, the only fats they had were what they made on the farm. So they rendered their – I mean, I can even remember going to – butcherings when my uncle still had the farm. And you know, they say, oh, you use everything but the squeal. So to render lard, there's the leaf lard, which is, I believe, around the kidneys, which is a more delicate fat and is supposed to be the supreme fat for pie mm-hmm. making. So that can be separated out. But mostly all the pig fat can be, I've made it by cutting it into chunks, not too small, and putting it in a pan in the oven. And you just kind of, on a lowish sort of heat, 300, 275, and you let the fat melt. And you just keep pouring it off and straining it, and you know, and it goes down to smaller and smaller pieces. And what's left, people also eat as, they're kind of like cracklings. You can, you know, it's the crispy bits that, you know, so that you don't have to waste any of it. But that's how you render lard. It's a very easy process.
Ideally, you melt it. It turns clear in the heat.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You strain out the icky bits.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it solidifies up again, it gets that and milky white.
Yeah, and it stores really well in the fridge. So what my mom was telling my son was when she moved from the farm to Cape Girardeau, which was a town of about 30,000, she switched to Crisco because at the time, and this is still true, this is why I wouldn't just buy the normal packaged lard at the supermarket. She said you didn't want to buy lard from someone that you didn't know because, you know, it might not have been refrigerated properly. It does go rancid eventually. So people of her generation were concerned when moving off the farm and not being able to make their own. They bought what was considered cleaner, purer, more modern. And then she moved during the war, World War II, to Chicago. And so that was very, very urban. And, of course, my mother was not the only person. Large amounts of people left rural America and moved into cities during those periods. And shortening was touted as sophisticated, cleaner, more modern. Pigs were like for poor people to eat, you know, and there was the whole.
That's ironic. Chicago, the.
Yeah, the meatpacking center of the universe.
They have lots of pigs there.
I know. Well, lard has become almost a waste product. The meat processors kind of sell it to, you know, even the organic lard, like Organic Valley, just has to sell their excess pig fat off onto the market where it's, you know, processed into either lubricants or there's still a lot of Mexican restaurants do still cook with lard. So you might be finding it there. But I highly recommend just getting, because we have such a good local supply. We're really, really lucky. And, of course, everybody still knows that lard makes the best pies.
Yes, it does. It really does.
There was a period where there was some kind of organically derived shortening type of product, and now there are some other products that are marketed as vegetable shortenings that are non-hydrogenated. Here is the crux of the story, and this is the really, you know. Those of us with a historical memory must keep this sort of story in mind. Okay, so pig fat was denigrated. It was considered indigestible, unhealthy. The marketers and the health people went crazy at the turn of the century, saying, oh, no, don't eat that stuff. It's not good for you, da-da-da-da-da, eat this new product, da-da-da-da-da, and it got more processed fats, more, you know. Then, of course, we find out in fairly recent history, no big surprise, that both margarine and Crisco, which were invented to replace butter and lard, are actually very unhealthy. They're made from hydrogenated oils, which it turns out are highly artery clogging. Yeah. And very unhealthful. So do not eat any sort of, in fact, there are, I think in New York and some other places, they're outlawing the use of those hydrogenated fats because they are so, so unhealthy. So here we had a whole century where the processors of industrial food sold us a product replacing, you know, the things that humans have eaten for thousands of years, lard and butter and yum, 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 with the newfangled modern equivalent, which turns out to be radically dangerous for your health.
And it does seem that we buy it. We've listened to advertising, and we just plain follow.
Not all of us are going to do this deep biochemical research. It's just, and the research, frankly, had not been done. It's not like they knew it was bad and they were trying to pull the wool over our eyes. It's just that everybody thought, oh, isn't this cool? Look at this white, fluffy, oily stuff that comes in a can and doesn't need refrigeration and is so clean and so pure and so cool. And
it's, well, we were
lesson learned.
We were convinced by
ourselves, basically.
Actually, there were supposed doctors on radio telling us that not only LARP, but cigarettes at a time were considered.
Yeah.
So you never know.
I come back to this thing all the time where I have to say, we can send a man to the moon, but we still don't have really thorough science on what's going on inside our microbiome, how our food is digested, how nutrition really works. There's a lot we don't know.
Ha! Huh. I have a question. What is this term shortening? Reading in recipes, they say shortening. Now, that refers to lard, butter, Crisco.
Hardened at like refrigerator temperatures and still are fairly solid at room temperatures. I mean, soft butter, soft lard at room temperature is soft, but it's not olive oil. It's not liquid. It doesn't puddle up.
So why didn't they call it hard or soft? Why short?
It comes from the fact that that kind of fat with that structure does something to the gluten, and it's called shorting it. That makes it flakier.
Short strands of gluten.
There you go. So that's where the shortening word comes from.
Ah, there you go.
Because it's very good to bake with.
Yes, it does. Making things fluffy. Important to make things fluffy.
Fluffy cakes, fluffy pie crusts.
Good.
Yum.
Sheep, can you make... Do sheep have fat that we eat, or do you use sheep fat for other stuff?
Gee, I don't know. It's probably a rare commodity.
Right.
They're not particularly fat. It's like sheep's milk cheeses, which are wonderful. Huh? There's some breeds that are bred for, I mean, the pigs were actually, because the fat was so valuable, they were bred to be fatter and fatter. Mm-hmm. And some pigs have just, the wonderful quality of the fat. Mm-hmm. Now, it's the other lean white meat is, that's a whole other breeding going in the opposite direction.
Well, then there is chicken fat and duck fat, which is not shortening.
Absolutely.
Do you cook with that? I mean, do you bake
with that? Well, duck fat for cooking is highly, highly prized.
That's lovely stuff.
And people, I've had pastry crusts made with chicken fat.
Oh,
It's called schmaltz, the chicken fat,
yes,
when
that's
it's rendered.
The word. And one of the better words that we thank the Yiddish language for that.
Right.
Oh, that's a wonderful word.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Fats were not thrown away, I mean, do you remember even in our household, we had a little jar that was kept by the stove for bacon drippings?
Yes.
Something that makes food really good.
I still do that because as we are coming into the green season here, we have got like collards and kale coming up. And if you have some bacon drippings, that's a good way to start.
Well, lard is good for that too.
And lard is good for that too.
And duck fat is, especially in French cuisine, is highly, highly prized. It's a wonderful cooking fat. And then they do something like it's called confit, and we used to do this too when meats were canned. If you cook and pack meat, like shredded chicken, shredded pork, in fat, it preserves it quite a long time. So like a confit of chicken livers or a confit, that means they're just kind of cooked in the fat and then put into the jar with fat sealing it. Fat
That's
can
right.
seal
I've,
the tops
I've seen
of jars.
That. I've seen it. It's like the little cap that you put on.
Yeah, yeah. So don't waste those fats.
Oh.
Eat them judicious. Now, the other thing is lard has a healthier fatty acid profile than butter. It's got more of whatever the good ones are.
Mm-hmm.
So I think making cakes and pies with lard rather than butter is actually slightly healthier.
Lard, something that we probably don't think about much. And whenever you've got a pig or cow or any other kind of beastie, there's fat on it. And there's good, usable stuff. Tell us about the wonderful world of lard, Donna.
Well, you know, I this started a couple weeks ago. I decided to get on a campaign of really cooking with more lard and less, you know, we've all become very olive oil centric. But you know what? We don't grow olives around here. And the closest olive oils are probably from California, maybe Mexico. Most of them are coming from Europe. And I went, I gotta rearrange my brain a little bit. So I started looking online for a good book about lard. Even, you know, I just wanted to see what was out there. So I got one called 100% Natural Lard, The Lost Art of Cooking with Your Grandmother's Secret Ingredient from the editors of Grit magazine. So it contains 150 time-tested recipes from that your family will love. But I wanted it mostly because they have cake recipes in it.
Ah.
So this is my second cake that I've made with lard. This is a sort of pound cake. And I've brought some. What do you think? It's called a buttermilk pound cake. What do you think, Lana?
It is delicious. Very nice and moist.
Mm-hmm.
Golden and crumbly and good.
I would say it's certainly as good as baking with butter. It was kind of interesting, you know, because lard has a slight flavor to it.
Yes, yes.
And it's nice. It's rich. And mm-hmm. So when I first put it in a cake, I thought, how's this flavor going to go with the sweet flavors? And it's perfect.
It's wonderful.
You don't actually taste it, but it's there. It's like another layer of umami or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, you put this. This is a bundt cake sort of pound cake.
This was a problem. The recipe recommended using, lightly dust a tube pan with lard, grease, and then dust with flour. So I got my tube pan. I made the batter. And then when I poured it in, I thought, you know, this is an awful lot of batter for the tube pan.
Oh!
I came right up to the edge. So I stuck a baking sheet under it just mm-hmm. in case. It's a good thing I did because the cake, of course, completely overflowed and filled up the whole center cavity of the tube pan. Well, it's okay. It worked out. I got a cake within a cake. When I lifted the tube pan off, there was another, like, perfectly formed little conical cake. So,
oh, goodness, like the cone of a volcano in the middle there.
Yeah, yes, more or less. So really, it should have said bake it in a bundt pan. You need a bigger mm-hmm. a bigger cavity. But the recipe is, it was so easy. It was, and we'll put it on the website. So a cup of lard softened, and then you, with your little hand mixer, you beat in 2 cups of granulated sugar, and then you whip it up and let the sugar start to dissolve. Then 4 eggs, a cup of buttermilk. Now, I didn't have buttermilk, so I actually put in some of my kefir. And it says, then you beat in the flavor, which is they use two teaspoons of lemon extract. Well, of course, I had to add more. I put in a little orange extract and a little Fiore di Sicilia. And then I put in, which you can order from King Arthur Flowers, in case you don't know what that is. It's very floral and lemon. It's citrusy.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend to throw it in a lot of things. And then I put a little ground coriander seed, so it has a little more flavoring. So you make, and then you just, it's as simple as can be. Then you dump in 3 cups of flour and then 1/2 teaspoon of soda, salt, and baking powder. And you can do this all in one bowl with the mixer.
I like those kind.
I know.
Back up to the use of the lard. In what stage is the lard when you put it? Is it like white-looking butter, or is it kind of melty? Or
It's like, you know, how if you were making a pound cake with butter, you would soften it at room temperature.
Room temperature, and it pretty much...
And it just beats right into the sugar.
Okay.
Couldn't be simpler.
courage out there, folks. Try something new. This is buttermilk pound cake.
Yeah, I'm going to try some things that I don't even have recipes for. The next time I have to bake, I'm just going to use lard, where I think you can make it a straight-out substitute for butter in a lot of your sort of cakey, bakey kinds of things.
There you go. So, lard. It's not just for pie crust anymore. You're listening to KHOI Community Radio. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been celebrating the wonderful world of lard. Do you have anything else to add about lard?
I just wanted to add one more thing, and this is true for butter and suet. Like everyone's, I have a Christmas pudding that was my grandmother's that I use suet in. So these fats, all three of them, the cow, the pig, the beef, and the butter, do have a long shelf life in the refrigerator and can be frozen. However, if you thaw some out or if you take some out of the fridge and it tastes a tiny, tiny little bit before you cook with it, because it can, all of those fats can ultimately turn rancid. And if it doesn't taste sweet and nice, don't cook with it, because it will ruin your cake. Just throw it away. But it's, all of those fats have a long shelf life, but do, you know, if you're not using your lard all the time, which many of us don't, and particularly suet, I've had a problem with it. When you're hauled it out of the freezer, oh, yes, we're going to make Grandmother Baumgartner's plum pudding for Christmas, and the taste of the fat was yuck, so I couldn't use it. So be careful. You'll know by tasting it. If it doesn't taste good, it will not taste good once it's cooked. So give it a smell and a slight taste before you put it in your cake.
Words of wisdom. Words of wisdom. Thank you, Donna. Well, we wish to do a little notice of a very important farm here in central Iowa.
Oh, yes.
Tell us, Donna.
Well, last weekend we went to the Practical Farmers of Iowa annual conference, where they always give the award, the Sustainable Agricultural Achievement Award. And this year it was given to Dean and Judy Henry, the longtime owners of the Berry Patch Farm near Novato. And we have had, we always in the spring get strawberry news from Judy, because they have a wonderful local you pick. And so they were given this award, because they've been farming around here for more than 50 years. They raise a variety of orchard fruits, berries, and other horticultural crops, the familiar ones, and then some interesting ones, like I think Judy's always trying something new. I think they're working on honey berries now. And in the spring, or no, probably by the summertime, we intend to actually get some honey berries and cook with them to see what, if it's going to replace blueberries.
Ha!
In Iowa, apparently they're easy to grow, and they're vaguely like blueberries. Of course, nothing's going to replace a blueberry, but, you know. So anyway, that's their latest experiment, and they farm with their son, Mike. And it's near Nevada, and it's a beautiful, beautiful farm, kind of gently rolling, you know. If you take your kids out there, they can actually climb the apple tree to pick the apples. And strawberry picking is always fun for children. You just kind of scoot along the ground, and I suppose children eat more than they pick, but it's congratulations to Dean and Judy Henry for their contributions to Iowa agriculture and good family fun.
Yes, good for them. Well, we're going to
explore a little item that's been in the news lately.
Oh, boy. Another thing.
Another thing to worry about. And, oh, goodness, gas stoves, Donna. Gas stoves. What's up with gas stoves?
Oh, boy. Well, this didn't just puff out of nowhere. You know, part of it is, of course, gas stoves, like gas furnaces, burn gas. And there's been this controversy going on for, it is a petroleum product, right? It does contribute to greenhouse gases. There's been a big push saying, oh, it's less harmful than it's been considered green because it's supposed to be better than gasoline. But, you know, it's all coming out of petroleum products. So the latest thing is they're talking about emissions from gas stoves, which most people have in their kitchens, are connected to an increased risk for childhood asthma, among other things. So, for example, the New York Times headline was, gas stoves are tied to health concerns. Here's how to lower your risk. So then in Congress, there was this thing saying, somebody was saying, oh, Joe Biden's going to outlaw gas stoves. Well, then the Republicans are saying, you know, you can come pry my gas stove out of my, what's that saying? My cold fingers.
Cold dead fingers.
Yeah, something like that. It became another culture war. Well, of course, no such thing is happening. It was just another, I don't know, brouhaha in the press. However, there are certain, like in New York, I had been reading that for new restaurants, for example, the city of New York is apparently requiring no more gas hookups and some of the sort of more famous chefs, this is well over a year ago or something, or two maybe even. So, they were having to put in these new, what are they called, Lana? Induction cooktops. Were having to be installed in restaurants. And so those chefs were, you know, queried by the press. Well, what do you think of these? Da, 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 da. Well, of course, they're more expensive to put in. However, the chefs are saying, yeah, once you get used to it, we really like it because they do. It's not like your regular electric stovetop. It heats up really fast and, people are switching to them. So it's made a debate, you know, do you run out and switch out your gas stove because it's, you know, it's inside, and even a vintage stove, especially like in restaurants, they're burning these things all the time, and they are required by law to have huge, very big exhaust fans for lots of other reasons.
Oh, so the exhaust fans aren't just for the occasional time you may burn something on the top of the stove.
No.
But the gas stoves are emitting icky bits.
They emit something or other that it isn't good for us. And research indicates that emissions from gas stoves can be hazardous, and the something or other CPSC, whoever that is, Consumer Product Safety Commission, is looking for ways to reduce indoor air quality hazards. So, I mean, most of the articles I've been reading say, well, you know, if you have a gas heating system, you know, that's even bigger problem. So, you know, don't go think you have to go. I mean, of course, if you can afford it, good heavenly days, by all means, try a new induction stove. But there are ways to mitigate what you have at home. So when you use a gas stove, it emits poisonous gases called nitrogen oxides, including nitrogen dioxide, a respiratory irritant thought to trigger asthma. Cars, boats, and other machines also release these gases. Well, but you don't run your car in the house, right?
Yeah.
So that is a problem. Families who use gas stoves in homes with poor ventilation or without range hoods can blow past the national standards for safe hourly outdoor exposure to nitrogen oxides within just a few minutes. There are no agreed upon standards, et cetera, et cetera. So here are some things that you can do to mitigate what's in the house. Ventilate. This is according to the New York Times. You can open the windows, crack open a door, put on a fan. Now, of course, this time of year when it is so cold out, you're not going to be doing much of that. But it says fresh air can really dilute the concentration of the air pollutants. The other thing is, use your exhaust hood fan if you have one. Always turn it on, especially if you've got one that blows the air outside. That's really important. Not everybody does, but it does help. And they also say try to use the stove less often. Ah. Okay, so like toaster oven, microwave, electric kettle, you know, those kinds of things. And here's the one I did, okay? Because there's a lot of cooking going on in my kitchen, and I have some housemates that do a lot of frying, as young people are wont to do, you know. Even the vegetarian fries a lot, you know, just fry this, fry that. And I was noticing every time I come into the kitchen, my eyes were starting to water because there's like stuff in the air. I could smell it, of course, and then I started to feel it. So I actually went out and got an extra air purifier for the kitchen. And it has made a difference. So I just have it sitting a little stool in the kitchen, and I leave it on something called the Econo setting because it has a sensor, and when it feels there's more stuff in the air, the speed of the fan goes on high. So I have now trained everybody to always use the hood exhaust fan when they're cooking. And then I have this air purifier that goes on high duty when it senses that there's more stuff in the air. So now all I have to do is remember to change the filters periodically and things like that. But that was my one concession. Of course, everybody is different. I am looking at maybe, I do have a hood vent that is custom built over my stove, but I'm looking at maybe putting a stronger fan in that. Ooh. That might not be too complicated. But it is something else to worry about. There you go.
Yeah, so it got Donna and I thinking about things like using other things to cook with in your kitchen. But Donna gave me something to try out.
These induction things.
An induction cooktop. Now, this is what, you can buy a whole stove like this, but I would just, this is one burner.
One burner thing.
Pretty fancy. First off, this thing takes up a lot of your counter space, so it's good for testing. But I wouldn't put my counter space away to use this thing because it's pretty big. It's bigger.
Would it be like 18 by 18?
Yeah. It's pretty big. Mm-hmm. But another thing that, well, in my house, I had to experiment because wherever I plugged it in, I would blow a fuse. That's fun. That's real fun.
It slows down your cooking a little.
So I had to jerry-rig things around. Got that working. But another thing you have to do is an inventory of your cookware, because that's the main thing here. These induction cooking surfaces.
It's magnetic, right?
It only works if you have a cookware that is capable of a magnet sticking to it. So I took a little magnet off of my refrigerator and went around touching all of my pans.
Your Revere pans will not work on it.
I have some very nice Revere pans, and they will not work. You can't use copper. You can't use glass.
You can use cast iron, though.
You can use cast iron, and you can use stainless steel with magnetic bottoms, and you can use magnetic iron pans.
The ceramic ones, right?
No.
Like Le Creuset?
Oh, yes.
Because they're cast iron covered with enamel.
Cast iron, yeah. So be prepared. If you're going to buy a whole new stove with this kind of cooktop, get new.
Well, there covers. Is a thing. I saw it on Amazon, so they must have it other places. It's kind of like that heat diffuser trivet. You can set that on the induction burner, and then on top of that, you can put your regular pans. And actually, it was like $25, not terribly expensive. I must say, the next time I have to buy a new stove, which seems to happen every 10 years or something, I will consider getting one because, when they work really well, right?
The burner is adjustable. You can get, the numbers go up and down.
And you can set it at the exact temperature you want.
supposedly they're really efficient. And, you know, I've only had this for a week, and it works great once I figured out
all that. Tell us about boiling water.
Oh, it boils, like, real quick, Donna, real quick, and it beeps and it does things, and it boils. It had this little pan of water was going in half a minute.
It's much better than, you know, when you think electric stove and you go, oh, da-da-da-da-da-da. Now, I did cook on electric stoves for years. You get used to whatever you've got.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I would be open to getting an induction stovetop unit when the time comes.
Yeah, I would too. I kind of did a test with some Yeast Raised buckwheat pancakes. This is the kind of thing you have to kind of stand there and watch it happen. Otherwise, you just do that with pancakes. And I used my biggest cast iron skillet, and it worked beautifully. Actually, when I did it on my gas stove with cast iron, I could never get the temperature just about right, my kitchen would get all smoky, but the pancakes were always good. This way, anyway,
because it's electronic and computer controlled, you can set the temperature and it will stay even.
It will stay even, and so, like Donna, I think we have to get the power source sort of figured out here. But other than that,
well, they are offering, the federal government is offering rebates on this kind of equipment. If you want to replace your stove, you are eligible for some rebates. And I do believe there's even a rebate in case you have to do some rewiring to plug that induction stove in. So they are helping us to make the switch. Uh-huh. If you're buying one, be sure to get your rebate back for this. Because they're a little bit more expensive, but I think with the rebate, it brings it within reason, with the typical gas stove.
And they are supposed to be more efficient and all. So, old dogs here can learn new tricks if we have to. We can learn this stuff.
Yeah, well, thanks for trying it out.
Well, yeah, I'll give it another try. I'm not too thrilled about switching out all my cooking pans, but, well, we'll see. We'll see. And
maybe we'll have to get one of those little gizmos from Amazon that makes everything work.
Yeah, the gizmo work. Yeah, I like that. Mm-hmm. That's good. Well, this is KHOI. This is Community Radio. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about all kinds of good stuff today. If you would like to find out more about the Donna Lana Kitchen, go to www.khoyfm.org. Find out more about this radio station and a whole bunch of other good programs that are available. And you can find out more about the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find recipes. You can find past shows. You can even see a picture.
And we have a podcast, too.
And a podcast.
Anywhere you listen to your podcast, just type in Donna Lana. That's one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, Kitchen. And there we will be.
If you just can't get enough of us. Very good. Well, let's talk about more food stuff, Donna. I have a little home business. I have a guest house, a bed and breakfast at my place, and so occasionally we have guests, and sometimes people leave things in the room as a tip for the maid, me, who comes in and does things and cleans up. And this last week, really nice man left me a packet of black garlic, and he was talking about black garlic, and I have this, it looks like garlic gone bad, Donna, but really, it's really tasty. We're going to talk about black garlic
today. It's a thing. I don't know if I walked into the bedroom and found three heads of black garlic, you might be taken aback at first. They look a little bit like something rather undesirable. Okay, it is historically, it's an Asian product used, it's a fermented product.
It's a fermented product.
And, it's become quite a bit of a culinary rage. Now they're using it in European foods and now here, and you can buy it mostly at Asian markets, but probably some more high-end supermarkets. I have not seen it locally available here, but, it's, What you can do is make your own. So Lana and I have decided that June or so, when they have their garlic harvest, we're going to take some of it and we're going to try this. So the trick for home garlic fermenting is a rice cooker.
Ha! Now see, I've looked into this before, and the Asian method or the traditional method is, oh, you dig a hole and you line it with straw, and it sounds pretty awful because it's a long fermentation process. So, but you can do this with.
Well, we'll see. We're going to test this out before we declare. But here's what I read. So you put it in the rice cooker. And you turn it on, not on the cook button, but the keep warm button, and you leave it there for 21 to 28 days.
Ah!
A long time.
That's a long time.
That's a long time to run that rice cooker, but we will give it a try next time when we have that really fresh, beautiful, wonderful garlic. In the meantime, I'm eating a piece now.
Yeah, it has an amazing. Well, I love garlic anyway, but this does not taste just like garlic.
It doesn't taste like garlic at all. It tastes, of course, a little burnt. But I'm wondering if when we make our own, if that can be avoided. I don't know. There's the bitterness of that. And then it tastes almost like balsamic vinegar.
Yeah.
It's not quite as sour. This clove is a little chewy and more dried out. I have seen it where, for example, I read a recipe from a French cookbook where it's more like a paste, and you kind of spread it with your thumb across a little salad plate, and then you put some goat cheese on top of it and kind of smush the goat cheese just lightly into the garlic that you've spread there. And then I believe they served it with some halved pitted cherries and maybe some crumbled nuts on top or something like that. But it's a... Well, what happens in the fermentation product is the allicin is changed.
Allicin,
A-L-L-I-S-O-N or S-C-E. Anyway, allicin is one of the chemicals in garlic that makes it
garlic.
Tastes like garlic. Yeah, exactly. And is also medicinal. So it has a lot of antioxidants in it. Whether you're making black garlic or regular garlic, you know, our saying is garlic is better than 10 mothers or something like that. So this is just another way to eat garlic. When you ferment it, that sharp bite that you get from the fresh garlic is tempered. It sweetens it. And it gives it that kind of almost malty, vinegary kind of flavor.
Yeah.
So it tastes completely different. You know, oh, this is garlic. No, this is aged garlic.
Yeah.
So you can cook with it and you can chomp on it and all kinds of things. It is a whole nother flavor. Oh, Lana, you mentioned some three garlic recipe something.
Well, first I want to mention, I have a note here, some information. I have a flavor profile of this garlic. Referred to as licorice or tamarind or caramel. Maybe if you mixed all that together. But anyway, it's a pleasant sort of thing. I had some of, so here I sit with this black garlic. So I got out a recipe book by Otto Lenge, which is he does fancy things. So he had a three garlic sauce, or three garlic spread that you put on top of some flatbreads. And I made some flatbreads because I kind of like to keep my hand in doing things like that. And so I made some flatbreads in the oven. And then this three garlic sauce, a lot of olive oil, it had a tiny bit of paprika in it, but it had regular raw garlic and
cooked garlic. I sautéed the cooked garlic in the olive oil.
Lightly. You don't want to burn
don't
the cooked
burn it,
garlic.
Don't burn it, right. But soft, soft.
Right.
That's kind of a different flavor, too, as opposed to the mm-hmm. raw garlic chopped up. And then adding chopped up black garlic to this. And I think I put in a little bit of chopped up parsley, too. It had other things you could add if you had it. But that was a sauce, a dipping sauce to go on to the... Oh, that was really good. The three different kinds of garlic.
So, yes, and if you think you're getting a cold, you better be having some of this stuff.
It will help. It will
help.
It's
our favorite medicine.
Black garlic. What a good idea. So, I'll try that. The nice man who left this black garlic tip for me said he went out and bought an official, you can get an official black garlic cooker. And he was doing his garlic that way, which is probably pretty much like a rice cooker. But we'll see. We'll see.
This one tastes a little bit more burnt than some that I have tasted before. So I would say if you're going to home do yours, you know, maybe start. And you've got the rice cooker going, starting, you know, along day 20 or something. Give it a little taste and see if it's done, and judge by the taste. Because obviously you can overcook it, I think, a little.
Well, good.
Over-ferment, maybe. Who knows?
Good. But anyway, garlic. It's a good winter thing. It's good anytime. Black garlic. I have a few news items here. Just to mention that... In our night sky, we should be able to see a comet evidently going by, and it's supposed to be long about around Mars someplace we can see it, but there is a comet.
Now, does that mean it's going to be moving and you have to decide if it's an airplane or...
No, it doesn't move that fast. And you probably will need binoculars or something to see it, but if you ever have seen a comet in the sky... It has a tail. It does have a tail.
Oh.
And that's how you can tell. Oh, it won't be visible. It'll only be visible like this week up until February 2nd. So get out there and see. And it's supposed to be really close to Earth and a very auspicious thing happening. So there, and it's supposed to be sort of green colored, believe it or not. I don't know why. That's a news item. Another news item. Here's a local news item. And this is under the category of you don't know what you got till it's gone kind of thing. We have been missing our local food co-op bakery. They've been doing some remodeling.
Yes, they're putting in a new hood in their kitchen.
Speaking about ventilating.
To keep the ventilation better. Well, because flour and bakers notoriously have lung problems from inhaling too much flour over time.
Oh.
Aha.
So good. But anyway, it's been a long, cold month. I've been, you know, you go in there and you think, could use a nice loaf of bread, and they do such a good job. And there's this lovely sign that says coming soon. So I hope coming soon means coming soon. Is it? Yeah. All right.
Supposedly anyway. Later this week they will resume. We'll see.
Very good.
You know how constructions are. You never know.
You never know. So we'll welcome back the bakers. Also, thanks for joining us. We're so glad you joined us around our kitchen table. Coming up next week on the Donna Lana Kitchen, we'll have a special guest talking about local food systems, and it'll be good. It will be very good. We've had music by the Barn Owl Band today. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find us here live Tuesdays at noon. At noon. We do this live, Donna. We've been doing this for quite a while. It's been fun. And we are repeated on this fine station Tuesdays at 7 p.m. in the evening. So you can find us there. You can go to www.khoifm.org. You can find us live there. You can go to the streaming service and listen to us anytime.
Or our podcast, The Donna Lana Kitchen, anywhere you listen to podcasts.
So we are out there, and we hope you put us in your ears.
We just want to encourage you to cook.
Cook, taste, enjoy life, yes. Support this fine radio station. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Excellent engineering by Mike Murphy.
Eat good food and enjoy life.